Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour for May 13th, 2021. And many topics to cover tonight. I'll be talking about the fake world water shortage, a little bit about that. I've been talking about that recently and all the big push. And by the way, that's what the global warming thing is all about. And boy, they got the woke people out there running around, jumping up and down, they're going to save the world, climate change. It's all about water. Control of water. That's what it is. And, you know, that's the thing. Woke people are so usable. They are so usable that, they spring on to everything that comes along. And it's like they don't understand how the world works and how it's being manipulated. Whether it's COVID, whether it's climate change, whether it's water shortage, whether it's gas shortage, oil shortage, you name it. It's like, oh, we all got to jump up and down and do this. Whoa, and aren't we smart? No, you're not smart. You're really dumb. And you're really playing right into the hands of the world controllers. It's really pathetic. But you and I pay for this because these people are out there and, you know, they have no idea. Or communism, Marxism, you know, identity politics, wokeness politics, it's all driving the United States into a communist manifesto. Well, let's see. The new HI filter elements, I talked about that last week. This week I'll be talking about the water filter industry, something that I was talking about history of water filtration, and I'll be mixing that in with today's industry. What the industry is like today. And that's really important because when you go out to buy a water filter, let me tell you, there's people out there that are really saying things that are really incorrect. Like one I just read, somebody was touting their water filter product, a gravity water filter element, and they said, removes 99% of viruses. There is no gravity water filter filter on the market that removes 99% of viruses. It's simply a false claim. It is a false claim. It is. Now imagine what it would take to test this. You would have to have all the viruses in existence, pass them through your filter in a standard laboratory, and this would not be your average laboratory. This would have to be a category or level 5 bio lab, because you have these live dangerous viruses, and then test the filter for the lifetime of the filter. Nobody's ever done this. How can somebody claim that they remove all viruses? It's bizarre. But that's the first claim. And then I saw another one just the other day. Removes 99.99% all viruses. What? Where did you have this tested? What level 5 lab did you have this tested where they have all viruses there available to pass through your filters and then measure the outcome coming out the other side? I mean, this is crazy. Crazy, crazy, Looney Tune crazy. People are making claims about water filtration that are simply not true. I mean, they couldn't possibly be true. But people are making them. Anyway, I'll be talking about the water filter industry today and then something called the Betts Law. Anyway, when you get done with this little lecture, you will understand more than the top people in the federal government agencies that deal with wind power. You will know more than the top engineers at General Electric and Siemens and Vesta, who believe this. There's something called the Betts Limit, which describes, and I'll go into detail here, but it describes the so-called maximum amount of energy that you can get out of a column of air. And it's really bizarre. It's really bizarre how people have just don't know what they're talking about. Okay, so anyway, just a little bit here about the fake world water shortage. And yesterday morning on John Moore's show, The first caller, woman, she was from Arizona. They're experiencing a water shortage because of a lack of rain, a drought, and asked me about could they divert water, especially for agriculture, because Arizona is a big agriculture state. But it's using water that comes in, it's shipped in from the nearby reservoirs, etc. And so my comment was that don't try and move water because you have a very bad agricultural system that uses a tremendous amount of water, and they're spraying fields, and 95% of the water that they spray into the fields in a hot, dry area like Arizona, it's just going whoosh, right up into the air and away. So you're wasting most of that water. Even with drip irrigation, you're wasting a lot of the water. A lot of that water is simply going into the air and is lost. So you need a system which contains the water that you have. And that's why the grow towers that I sell are especially good for a place like Arizona. You have great sun, you have a limited amount of water, and also they are using chemical fertilizers. They have to, because the desert, long ago, if there was any agricultural value, any nutrients in the sand that's there, it has long since gone. But you can grow great crops if you have fertilizers, especially modern ammonia fertilizers, and water. Now, what if you take a contained environment, which is the grow tower? It's a tank at the bottom. It has the nutrients, and these are organic nutrients. They're not ammonia chemical fertilizers, which give you a beautiful corn or lettuce or whatever you're growing. They look very nice, but there's no food value. There's no minerals. There's no enzymes that have grown in these plants. They look very nice, but there's no food value. And that's why a lot of Americans are sick, because they're eating vegetables. They go to the store. They have all those beautiful apples lined up there, oranges or pears or, you know, lettuce or whatever. But there's no food value in them. There is zero food value. And so, and the reason is because they're using ammonia fertilizers. It makes the plants grow good. They look really nice. You know, you have states and states full of corn and soybeans. They look really nice, but there's no food value there. Not to mention their hybrid seeds, which GMO, genetically modified organism food, which is really not food. And so Americans are eating all of this food, which has no food value and a lot of chemicals. Anyway, getting back to the grow towers, the grow tower base has organic nutrients in it. In the water, it goes into a solution of water, and then you filter the water before it goes into the system using one of my water filters, the whole house water filter if it's an agricultural facility. And you only have to change this water out like once a month, and you have to add solution to it maybe once a week. And it's using the same water over and over again. Every 15 minutes, the pump goes on, a little bit of electricity, and it raises the water up in a tube, and then it sprinkles it down inside the tube, where it moisturizes the root systems that are inside the tube, and then the plants are coming out the ports. And you can have up to 54 lettuce plants in a tower in the space of one lettuce plant on the ground, or in a hydroponics. Hydroponics is the same. You have a flat surface and the plants are growing out of there, and you flood the region, but you're limited in the amount of space. So the grow towers are very economical in space. And also, here's something, and they use 95% less water. So you're only using 5% of the water, and that water is actually literally going into the plant, not into the air someplace. And so a place like Arizona, you could put a farm out there with a couple thousand grow towers, a commercial operation, use less water than it would take to say, cover an acre of land with open-air farming, and have organic products, very good quality with very good food value, and purely organic. Good grief. I mean, this is the way things should be going. So is there a water shortage? Well, in a sense, yes, in the traditional sense. But is there a real water shortage? No, it's a water management problem. They're making poor usage of the water that's there. Same with agriculture in California. But what if you're in New Jersey? Okay, what do you do if you're in New Jersey and you want to grow fresh crops? Well, you have an indoor facility and you have grow lights. So the grow lights, people in Arizona have pretty good sun. But in the wintertime in Arizona, you only have maybe 10 hours of sun a day, and then the sun goes down. What do? Well, you have a shorter growing day. But if you're in New Jersey in the wintertime, what do? Well, you have indoor grow facilities. But where do you get the energy for the grow lights? Well, you can get it from the grid and pay the grid prices for industrial electricity. And then just work that into the cost of your operation, which will be your biggest line item in your business. Or you can install a wind generator, put your facility, say, near a place where you have good wind, which there are plenty in New Jersey, or any other place, and grow your products there in a warehouse. Completely enclosed, completely controlled environment, very clean, etc. Okay, so the whole issue here, though, is there a world water shortage? And the answer is no. There is not a world water shortage. There is a worldwide water management problem. It's a management crisis. Okay, just a quick note on shutting down the pipeline. If you don't think this was planned, boys and girls. Just as the country's getting back to normal after COVID and things like that, people are saying no more checks. I found this interesting that the governor of Missouri made a mandate. He said, do not send any more federal money to anybody in our state. Stop the unemployment, the mandated unemployment for COVID, because people are not going back to work. They're getting too much money on unemployment, and so they're not returning to their jobs. And this is costing the employers. It's really a horrific situation. So anyway, the shutting down, just as the country is getting back to normal, they shut down this pipeline and go, oh, it was some hackers. Well, boys and girls, if you believe that, I got a bridge to sell you. This is all planned, just like the Texas power outage was planned. Absolutely planned. I mean, if you were in charge of a pipeline that the entire eastern part of the country is dependent on, don't you think you would have some cybersecurity experts maybe working at your place so that you don't get hacked and you don't have your network exposed to the internet to hackers? I worked in computer security for 25 years. That's what I did. A lot of people don't know that because I did not announce it publicly, because the people that hate me would try and go after my income. So that's all past now, so I can tell you and make it public. So that's what I did to make my, in fact, it wasn't my main source of income. It was a rather minor source of income compared to the other sources of income that I had. But also, I worked as in very secure settings. For 10 years, we built telecommunications processors that were used in industry, the oil industries, private industries, banking industries, and then also in government around the world. So these were very secure networks. So it's something I happen to know a little bit about. And no, you would not expose the U.S. pipeline that feeds oil, essential to our existence and economy, and put it on the internet. I just am in awe at the stupidity of these people. Okay, well, anyway, wasting showtime talking about stupid people. I could spend hours and hours talking about stupid people in private industry and government. Oh, good grief. It's terrible. Anyway, Just a quick mention. Last week, I introduced my HI filter product line. So I'm not going to repeat. I want you to go back and listen to the May 6th radio show. And I detail why this upgrade came along, etc. And what I've done is I've taken my GF technology and improved on it. And so, anyway, go listen to that. They have all of the same properties as the GF filters, but they are, anything can be broken if you smash it hard enough. But the GF filters were made of ceramics, and they had an issue of during shipping, or sometimes if people held the ceramic part when they were trying to tighten it down, they could break them, etc. Well, the new ones are much less susceptible to being broken. They also will take out gas that sometimes in water is a pretty rare thing, but some people say, my water smells. Well, that's gas coming out of your water. The new IHI filters will remove gas from the water. The show last week talks about that, but they're the same price. The pricing has stayed exactly the same. And that's a major announcement. I will be getting stainless steel containers in shortly. And so there's another thing. Nobody else has stainless containers, and neither did I for a while. But I have gone to great lengths to, and I had to do things that nobody else has done, to be able to get large quantities of stainless steel containers. And so anyway, that's coming along. And plus, I still have the MR5 whole house water filters. They will have the new HI technology also, which will be, these are big 20-inch filters. They're big filters, and you have five of them in a canister, and that gets you the flow rate. So anyway, the next topic I want to talk about is called the Betts Law. Now, this is going to be my science topic for the night, the main science topic. Where this is going is there's an industry standard that's been used for literally 100 years in the wind energy industry. It is that old, people trying to make devices that work in the wind. And I finally invented the thing that really works, based on aerodynamic principles, etc. And part of the problem has been people have been marching down the wrong road because of misconceptions. This is going to be a little bit of an insight into what we call kinetic energy transfer. And I'm going to talk about airplanes, and I'm going to talk about wind energy systems. And so the whole idea here is to look at what a kinetic energy transfer is. And basically, the Betts Law, if you look it up on the internet or look it up in an engineering manual or whatever, it was discovered. And what it amounts to is the question is, if you're trying to extract energy from a column of air or column of water, as in the case of a hydro dam, how much energy can you actually extract from the system, and is there a maximum amount? And so there's a belief, and I've talked to engineers before, and the first thing they do is they go, well, here's the kinetic energy in the system. And so that the belief is that the only energy in the system is kinetic energy. That's wrong. I mean, this is patently wrong. And let me just put it this way. If that were true, airplanes couldn't fly. And I'm going to explain that to you right now. Imagine you have a model airplane in a wind tunnel. We're going to do all of this in a wind tunnel because it's a little easier to understand. You have a tunnel of air. There's a big fan at the end of the tunnel, which is creating the wind. And then you put your airplane or your wind generator or whatever in this wind tunnel. So that's the easiest way to explain this. So we have a kind of a standardized test facility to, and this is going to be what we call a Gedanken experiment, a thought experiment. It's something you have to conceive of in your mind. Okay, so now take an airplane, put it in the wind tunnel, you mount it on a sturdy post, and there's the airplane all by itself, and you're going to be able to measure the lift on the airplane
based on the wind coming into the airplane on the nose side of the airplane and hitting the wings, and then you have the drag on the fuselage and on the engines, etc. And what is the lift? How much lift are you going to get out of this airplane? And the first thing we're going to do on the airplane is we're going to put flat boards, just flat boards, okay? And now imagine, here's another thing, if you're a skier, say a water skier, and or even a snow skier, you have two boards on your feet. There's nothing aerodynamic about them. They're just boards. They have a little flip up at the front end, but they're just boards. And so, like, if you get behind a power boat and you're on your water skis and the boat gets up to speed, what are you doing? You're pushing the boards against the medium, which is the water. And if you go fast enough, the boards cover enough water area where it provides enough lift to keep you up. If the boat goes too slow, you start sinking down into the water and you start having a tremendous amount of drag, but you can still kind of keep up. Anyway, these are flat boards. So now imagine on your airplane in the wind tunnel, you have flat boards on the wings. Okay, now you turn on the fan on the wind tunnel, and the question is, how much energy is lost? How much drag is there? And therefore, how much engine power do you have to supply to make that airplane go forward and fly? It's because the airplane weighs so much, so it's a simple vector equation. The weight of the plane is down. The lift of the wings is up. The pressure of the wind coming in the front side, that causes drag, so that causes a vector of drag, and now you have to put the engines on there, and they're going to push this thing forward if you took it out in a real-world situation. And then if you put enough power behind the engines, in the engines, therefore, this thing would be able to fly. Okay, so it's a very, there's four vectors. There's the lift of the wings, there's the weight of the airplane going down, there's the drag of the airplane, and then there's the force of the engines. There's four vectors here. Okay, so now we're going to turn the fan on in the wind tunnel, and all we have on the wings are flat boards. And this is the whole point of a kinetic energy transfer. Now, you're going to tip the plane up or the wings up so that the wind comes in, hits the underside of the flat board wing, the wind is deflected down, and therefore that causes an upward force on the flat board. That is a pure kinetic energy transfer, because the wind coming in hits the wing, bounces down, which makes the wing go up. And now, if you had an airplane like this, the airline industry would be in rough shape, because what you have out there is a wing, and it's called a wing, like a bird's wing, and it has an aerodynamic shape. So now we're going to replace our boards, which is a true kinetic energy transfer. There's no lift. There's no aerodynamic lift on the flat board. It's just a board. And so when the wind comes in, it hits the wing, the wind goes down, it's deflected down by the flat wing, and that creates lift. And that's a kinetic energy transfer. And there's a limit to how much you're going to get out of that, because there's another issue. There's a lot of drag that's being caused by that wind wing. As the wind hits it, some is being deflected down, but remember that wind is coming into the front side, the nose side of the airplane, and so it's also pushing the wing backwards. There's two vectors that come off the wind hitting that flat board. One is pushing it backwards, and one is where the wind is being deflected downwards, and that makes the wing go up. This is the flat board wing. Now let's replace the flat board wing with an aerodynamic wing that has an airfoil. What is the difference? And it turns out, I'll give you the answer before we start here, it's about a tenfold increase in force, in lift force. Okay, and this is how it happens. Let me use another example here. Now, let's take an automobile, and let's take a semi-trailer truck going down the highway. the truck is going down the highway, and the back of that truck is flat. So what happens? The faster the truck goes, the air comes around the side of the truck, and then it tries to get back and flow around the back side of the truck. But what happens? Because air is a compressible medium, it's not a perfect fluid, it comes around and it leaves a vacuum in the back of the truck. So some semi-trucks that go across country, you'll see kind of a flange that comes around the back of the truck. And what that does is it allows the airflow to come around the truck, and it reduces that vacuum at the back of the truck. So literally, the faster the truck goes, the more vacuum that's being created, or the car, and that's literally sucking the truck backwards. There's a vacuum behind the truck. And the same thing happens for a car. So people talk, for example, about putting a new carburetor onto a car, that, you know, you get 200 miles out of the carburetor. Well, it's not going to happen because the car design itself will not allow that level of efficiency. Because what's happening is in a, say, an SUV that has that square back, if you're going 70, 75 miles down the highway, 70 miles per hour down the highway, then the wind is creating a vacuum back there in that flat back of the vehicle and sucking it backwards, okay? Now, here's what happens with a wing, an aerodynamic wing. We put the airplane back in the wind tunnel. We put on the fan, the same amount of fan wind speed that's coming into the aircraft. And so it's the exact same scenario as before, the same wind speed, etc., except the only difference is now you have airfoil wings on the airplane, not flat boards. What is the difference? You're still going to have that wing a little bit of an angle, but not as much as the flat board. And what happens is some of the wind is going to hit the underside of the wing, and it's going to cause pressure on the underside of the wing. But the thing that's really causing the lift is the wind that comes over the front side of the wing. And if you look at a well-designed wing, it's round. It's a perfect circle on the front edge. So the wind comes and the wind splits. Some of it goes up above and some of it goes down below. And so the part that goes below, there's a little bit of an angle to the wind, to the wing. And so the wind is hitting the bottom of the wing and causing more pressure than if you had a dead air situation. But what really happens is some of that air goes over the top side of the wing. And just like in the back side of the semi-trailer, it can't get down to the wing. The faster and faster you go relative to the wind cannot get back down on the top of the wing that fast, and so it creates a vacuum. There's another way of looking at this. Most people look at it in terms of what is known as the Bernoulli principle, but what's really happening here is you're creating a vacuum on the upper side of the wing, and that vacuum is literally what lifts the vehicle up, the airplane. And you'll see some airplanes now have a little flip-up at the end of the wing, and that is something that the Wright brothers discovered when they very first had an airplane. They went out in the field and they calculated how much lift they should get off of a wing, and they had kind of a square-shaped wing. And they went out and they really couldn't get enough lift off of this, and they couldn't figure out why, so they went back and they actually created the very first wind tunnel. And they put their model of their airplane into the wind tunnel, and then they tried different configurations of wings, and they did something very interesting. They did a smoke trailing, and what they discovered is that the underside of the wing had higher pressure, the upper side of the wing had less pressure, but the wind was coming around the edge of the wing, the tip of the wing, and over the top of the wing and ruining the vacuum on the top of the wing. So they figured out that the longer wing worked better. Even though you had exactly the same surface area, you had exactly the same amount of area of your wing, the long wing worked better. And they didn't really realize, now let's take a look at a vulture or a condor or an eagle, a soaring bird. Look at any of them in flight, and you'll see at the end of their wings, they have a group of feathers, that stick straight out from the end of their wings, and they're flipped up. So what happens? As the air from the underside of the wing comes up, those feathers redirect the wind up and away from the top side of the wing, and that gives you a better vacuum. These are the principles of aerodynamics. And so I could go on and on about this topic, but the point here is what I've been trying to instruct you with is the difference between an airfoil and a kinetic energy transfer. Something that is, this is basic 101 physics, or at least aerodynamics 101 physics. The Betz law is something that has been used in the wind industry to give an upper limit of the amount of energy that is in a column of wind. And let me give you a perfect example of the use of the Betz law. Now, the Betz law has some assumptions when you go into the calculations and the theoretical construction of the Betz law. What happens is, let's take a hydro dam. You have a big lake, and then you have a funnel where the water pours over. It's near the dam. You have a dam then. It drops down, and down at the bottom of the dam in a housing, you have tubes where the water comes down the tube. So you get a lot of pressure because of the water pressure coming down this tube. It's a constant diameter tube. And it comes into basically a propeller blade type of system. But it's different than a regular propeller blade. It looks like a series of flanges. And what happens is, as the water enters this propeller, which is connected to the electric generator, by the way, as the water comes down into this generator, the water enters, and as you extract kinetic energy out of the water column, the water slows down because you have extracted kinetic energy. That's going into spinning the blade. Now, what happens as the water slows down, if you didn't make the flange expand and get bigger, in other words, the propeller blades go outwards it moves in a bigger diameter tube because the water's now moving slower. If you did not do that, the slower water would back up and create a back pressure up the tube, and it would limit the amount of energy you could get out of the water. So this is the design of a perfectly constructed example of the Betz limit, because water is a non-compressible fluid. You can use water, for example, in a hydraulic ram. You could use it in place of hydraulic fluids. What is a hydraulic fluid? It's a non-compressible medium. Now, let me ask you a question, all you engineers and even third graders out there. Would you use air in a hydraulic system? And a hydraulic system is where you have a hydraulic ram. There's a piston inside of a big, long tube. And then you have a little motor there, or sometimes a pretty big motor, that's driving pressure into that hydraulic fluid into the column, and that makes the arm go out. And you use these on big road equipment, etc. And so anyway, the hydraulic fluid in that hydraulic system is a non-compressible medium. The question is, would you use air in that system in place of hydraulic fluid? And the answer is no. And the reason is because air is a compressible medium. If you tried to pump air into that system, it wouldn't work very well at all, because air is a compressible medium. So the very first thing about the Betz limit is that air is a compressible medium. It doesn't apply. It does not apply to aerodynamic systems. The Betz limit refers to systems that are kinetic energy, and they have the fluid that's used, the Newtonian, they're called Newtonian fluid, so any fluid is a Newtonian fluid, but it would have to be like water or hydraulic fluid or oil or something that is non-compressible to work with the Betz limit. So they've been completely using this incorrectly. And I had a little run-in with let's say somebody high up in the wind energy world this past week, and immediately started spouting off about the BETS limit. And that's why I'm talking about this. Because everybody at General Electric or Siemens or Vesta or in the government or people dealing with government contracts, dealing with energy, have this belief in their brain that the maximum amount of energy you can get out of a wind system is limited by the BETS limit. And there's also another issue that if you have a system where you're extracting kinetic energy out of a moving column of fluid, then necessarily that column has to slow down because you're extracting energy from it. It's kinetic energy. Kinetic energy is energy of motion. And the equation for that is 1/2 mv squared. So the faster it's going, the bigger velocity, the square of the velocity times the mass. I mean, that just gives you the kinetic energy. And if you take some energy out of there, you're going to reduce, the mass is the same, so you're going to reduce the velocity, and therefore that's how you extract energy out of the system. But you can't take all of the energy out because the water would stop and it would back up your system and it wouldn't work anymore. So the BETS limits comes up with a number that's 59%. I believe it's around 59%. Anyway, that's the maximum amount of energy you can extract out of a kinetic energy system. But wind, it does not apply because, as I talked about in the airplane example, a pure kinetic energy airplane would be a flat board. An aerodynamic airplane wing would be an aerodynamic shape. And the reason you're getting lift out of this, you're not extracting energy out of the wind to create the lift. What's happening is the faster you go with your wing relative to the air, the more vacuum you're creating on the top side of the wing, and the only drag is that little bit of drag on the front of the wing. So it's not the drag on the front of the wing is not what's causing the lift. It's a cost, but it's not the energy that's used to lift the wing. It's the fact that you're creating a vacuum on the upper side of the wing, and that's pulling the wing up. And that's why a very small wing, a relatively small wing, can lift a 100,000-pound jet airliner. And that's why you have to start going down the runway. When you take off, the airplane starts taxiing down the runway. And all of a sudden, the vacuum on the upper side of those wings, you can see the wings starting to lift up, and pretty soon they lift up the entire airplane and away it goes off into the blue horizon, as they call it. But that's because, it's not because of the BETS limit. An airplane that had a physical kinetic energy transfer only, you would have to have engines 10 times as big as they are. They would use 10 times as much fuel and they would fly 1/10 the distance. You would not have airplanes flying around the globe. Okay, so anyway, the very important point here is that aerodynamic lift gives you a big advantage when you're creating aerodynamic systems. So when I created the wing generator, I knew this. And it's so incredible when you introduce this to people, the first thing out of all of their mouths is, well, you have a thing called the BETS limit. These people are ignorant morons. It's so typical where you have engineering schools. Let me use another example. People that believe hurricanes are caused by warm water. And it's universally believed in the meteorological world, in the universities, wherever you go. And you can do a very simple calculation. As a hurricane passes over the ocean, there's a slight drop in temperature of the surface of the ocean. and it's down to maybe a few inches in the surface water of the ocean, not very deep. But what's going on? Well, the wind of the hurricane is blowing over the surface of the water, and it evaporates the water. That's where all of the water comes in the hurricane. It's being evaporated off the surface of the ocean. And if you look at the amount of water that's in the hurricane and you calculate the latent heat of evaporation, that's a chemical term, what you will find is that the amount of energy loss due to that slight temperature change as the hurricane passes over the warm water is just equal to the amount of water in the hurricane itself. So that's where it's coming from. It doesn't power the hurricane. Good grief. Let me give you another example, a very simple example. You see a car going down the road, and it's the first time you ever see a car going down the road. And you ask a person, what's making this car go down the road? And you see that exhaust pipe coming out of the back of the car. So you think, well, this must be a rocket-powered car because there's exhaust coming out of the back of the car, out of the exhaust tube, and it's going one way and the car is going the other way. So it must be that the exhaust coming out the exhaust pipe at the tail end of the car is making the car go down the road. But you make a quick calculation and you realize that the amount of vapor and the speed that's coming out, and you look at the mass of the car and you go, well, this could not possibly be what's causing the car to go down the road. There must be something else going on here. And then you would lift up the hood and you go, well, gee, there's a big internal combustion engine in here with a transmission and a lot of loss due to all of the inefficiencies in the engine. And it's burning some kind of high combustible fuel called gasoline, and that's what's making the car go down the road. It's the same thing over and over and over again. Let me give another example. How about climate change? One of our favorite topics. And imagine that somebody believes that the greenhouse effect is going to raise the global temperature by 0.1 degrees in the next 20 years. Due to greenhouse gas emissions. Let's talk about that. Let's look at an automobile again, or how about a nuclear power plant, or a coal-fired power plant, for example, a little better example. So let's look at the coal-fired power plant. It is burning coal, and about 80% of the heat that's generated goes right up into the atmosphere right now. And then there's some carbon dioxide that's given off from the burning, and that carbon dioxide goes into the air. And the theory is that over a 10 to 20-year period, that carbon dioxide in the air is going to cause a trapping of heat into the atmosphere, and overall it's going to raise the Earth's atmospheric temperature by 0.1%. Well, it's about one gazillionth of the amount of heat that's going directly into the atmosphere right now. So, once again, science has nothing to do with the emotional contribution that people have towards climate change. Or how about the sun, which provides us minute-to-minute energy? And if, remember, at night, let's talk about this. As the nighttime comes, no matter where you are in the world, except if you're in the above the Arctic Circle in the summertime, then you have 24-hour sun. But the rest of us poor people that live sub-Arctic Circle zones, you have daytime and then you have nighttime. Well, what happens when nighttime comes? The temperature drops. The temperature goes down, and it might be a 20-degree drop during the nighttime. Well, what if the sun wasn't there when the Earth turns around and the sun's supposed to come up? What if the sun just wasn't there anymore? And you had one or two or three or 4 days with no sun. Or in the northern climates where you have very short days, it's the same effect. If you go way north, up in Canada or way south in Patagonia, very south, what happens in the wintertime? You might have a three-hour day. You might have 3 hours of sunlight, and it's very low on the horizon. And it's just not enough to heat things up, so that the temperature every day keeps dropping and dropping and dropping until you get into the depth of winter, it is really cold. I mean, the Earth is literally frozen. You know, the atmosphere is frozen. The atmosphere is extremely dry because any vapor in the air has fallen out. It has crystallized in the form of snow, and it's very dry. But the point being that we depend on a minute-by-minute influx of energy from the sun to keep us warm. And as soon as the sun goes down, as soon as it gets low on the horizon even, you start cooling down. And as soon as the sun goes down, the temperature starts dropping, like pronto. So how can you contribute the global climate change to one factor that is a greenhouse effect that's going to have an effect in 20 years when the sun and the energy being pumped into the atmosphere right now from every coal-burning plant, from every automobile, is going into the atmosphere right now? Right now. And what does the Earth do with all of that heat? It expels it every night. every night, all of that heat that comes from coal plants, from nuclear plants, gas-generated plants, from all of the industry that's burning energy, automobiles, trucks, lighting, everything, all of the energy produced from an electric plant eventually ends up as some form of heat and goes up into the atmosphere. 80% of what they're burning at the power plant, nuclear, coal, whatever, is going up into the atmosphere right now. And they don't count this. I mean, just incredibly bad science. And so let me get back to the idea of this Betz limit thing. It does not apply to wind at all because wind is a compressible medium. The Betz limit only applies to non-compressible fluids. So that's not air. It's water, it's hydraulic fluids, it's other forms of non-compressible fluids. And it's a kinetic energy transfer only, like the flat board on the wing. It has nothing to do with aerodynamics. Because as I said, if you look at the drag on the airplane that has the aerodynamic wing on it, it's not a kinetic energy transfer. It's not the wind hitting a wing and bouncing down and transferring kinetic energy that causes the wing to lift up. It has very little to do. In fact, there's very little loss compared to a kinetic energy loss that would make the wing go up. It's aerodynamic lift. It's the fact that air is a compressible medium and the fact that it is not a kinetic energy transfer that makes the airplane work. And so it's the same situation. I realized this when I designed the wing generator and patented it, etc. That's why it has a patent. But you can't get this into the little teeny brains of the people that are out there in this industry. Okay, so I think it's important. And like I said, now at this point, you know more than all of the engineers at General Electric. You know more than all the engineers at Siemens and at Vesta and all of the engineers and physicists and et cetera that work in the government that oversees all of the, the specifications for wind energy systems, et cetera. You know more than all of them combined because you listen to this show. Oh, my goodness. So anyway, I wanted to get in a little bit of time here talking about the water filter industry. And this is very important to understand where it is today. I started out this show by talking about water filter companies that are competitors. I don't think they're very good competitors, but they literally lie, and I'm not going to name any off on this show. But you can go see these for yourself. Pick your favorite, what you think might be a competitor of mine, gravity water filters, or just search for gravity water filters, and it'll pop up a list, of the common ones. But quite a few of them will say right out of the chute that they remove all viruses. That's absurd. It is absurd because viruses are very small. The standard way of killing viruses, and once again, filtration is not 100%. It's never 100%. And you have to also measure it relative to the length of the lifetime of the filter element itself. But the traditional and most effective way to deal with viruses is with a UV filter. And what happens is you have an ultraviolet light. It's in a stainless steel tube. And then the water goes in around the tube. And the light from the ultraviolet light shines through the water, and it's usually a couple feet long, so you have a certain flow rate. And in there, you will kill most everything that got through the actual filter. So this goes after your filter element. And some viruses may be filtered out. It's not simply pore size, but once you get into the medium, and this is what I want to talk about a little bit here, is that a solid filter that's a solid piece of material has very little surface area. And I'll have to explain that in a minute because it's all connected. But the idea that these are taking out viruses is just false. And let me look at another aspect of filtration is, are the water filters cleanable? And back in 2010, I happened to have been selling a brand of water filters that had black carbon filters. But anyway, in the 2010 flooding period, this was up in the upper Midwest, I took the ceramic filters that I was starting to sell, and I took the black carbon filters, and I took them out to a flooding area. And I took the water, the silty water that's in the flood, and I poured it in the stainless steel water container. And I had one with the black filters and one with my white carbon filters, or with my white ceramic filters. And what's going to happen here? So what happened is the black carbon filters plugged up, and you could not clean them. No matter how much you scraped them or whatever, they were plugged up because the silt is very small, and it gets in there and it clogs up the pores. Whereas the ceramic is a very smooth surface, and all you had to do is just scrape it clean, and it was working again. So the ceramics worked in that environment, but the carbon filters did not. And that was at the point where I just stopped selling the carbon filters. I no longer sold ever again the black carbon filters. But at any rate, the water filter industry is a very strange place. And there are a lot of claims out there that are really not valid. The one biggest thing that my filters have that nobody else has is that they are all in one. And the new HI filter elements that I introduced last week, they are the same as the GF filters which I was selling before. They were cleaning, so you are able to clean them. Also, they take out all of the chemicals, including fluoride, chlorine, glyphosate, volatile organic chemicals, heavy metals, etc., and now also are advertised as taking out radioactive materials, radiation. They don't remove radiation like alpha-beta particles, so that's, you have to understand, they remove the source of the radiation, which is an atom or a molecule. And so that is something that's new also, besides taking out gas. But the biggest advantage of my filters still is that you do not need add-on filters. Literally everybody else requires add-on filters just to remove chlorine and fluoride and in a lot of cases heavy metals. So I explained last week that the cost of these add-on filters is about three times the cost of the filter elements themselves. And I used to sell add-on filters. I know all about them. They only last for 500 gallons of usage. So if you have two filter elements in your water filter and you put two add-on filters, and at $39 a piece, that's $80. They only last collectively for 1,000 gallons. Your main filters are going to last for a couple thousand gallons. So now you're at about $160 just for the add-on filters. And they're only going to last for a couple thousand gallons. So, I mean, it gets really expensive. I showed the calculation last week that The average replacement filters of my competitors run around $300 per pair. Mine cost, they're about $39. If you buy a pack of four, they're about $39 for the filters that take out everything. So it's about $80 versus $300 for a pair of filters. And mine take out everything. The other thing with the add-on filters is they restrict the water flow. Okay, so let me just make a brief summary here relative to the water filter products. The new HI filters are in stock and shipping. We still can get the GF filters. And if you have the GF filters, there's nothing wrong with them. I mean, it's just like, you know, like car manufacturing going to a newer model this year. That's what's going on. And I still use the GF filters. I have filters in different places where I go, and I will continue using them. There's not a lot of changes. If you're not gentle with the GF filters, then the biggest issue is breakability. You're not going to be breaking them. They're cleanable. They have all the other same properties. But the HI filters, as far as manufacturing and marketing and things like that, it's a big benefit to me. Also, we're going to have the stainless steel gravity housings in shortly. That's coming very soon, plus the MR5 filters are using the new HI technology. And so anyway, this is a huge change. I mean, I've been selling the GF filters for literally over 10 years. So this improvement has been a long time coming, and it allows me to meet orders and ship things out in a very timely manner and produce here's one of the big issues. There's a huge necessity by the public for water filtration now with the PFAS filters or the chemicals, the forever chemicals in the water. People have to remove that from the water. And this is like everybody. This is a big issue. And with the ceramics, there was just a tremendous limitation on how many could be produced. So at any rate, major changes, major good changes going on, and will very much benefit a lot of people around the world. Also in third world countries, getting these to third world countries in one piece will be a much better, much easier thing to do. And I'm out of time here. I hope you enjoyed this evening's show. I hope you believe it was educational. I'll be bringing you a lot more. I'm in now my over 20 years of doing this radio show, the same time slot on WWCR and all the other venues where this rebroadcasts in the next few days. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. Remember my webpage, jmccsci.com. And we are at the crossroads. Good night.